The Integral Knowledge Study Center will now take up the Yoga of Integral Knowledge. So Sri Aurobindo was writing this lengthy description of the various ways of coming into oneness with the divine in the journal Arya. And after preliminary chapters and a description of the various ways in which we can bring our will, our life, our intent in life into common being with the divine's direction and into a felt oneness with that. Then he went on to take up what we call the Yoga of Knowledge. As he unrolled these essays in the Arya, he did not call a first section the Yoga of Divine Works. He did not describe a second section. He just went from chapter to chapter and kept moving. So the last chapter that he wrote in 1915 on the Yoga of Divine Works as we have it was the topic, as he styled it then, the work. Now, he redefined it when he expanded and greatly chiseled out some new insights so that they would be present in a new articulation of an integral yoga, called it the divine work. This chapter that we take up tonight, chapter one of the Yoga of Integral Knowledge, because in the early 40s he thought of bringing out the larger work of the synthesis after revision, and he would break it into these various sections. The first chapter is The Object of Knowledge. It was published in December of 1915, on the 15th day, as everything was, 15 December 1915. It was chapter 16 in the second volume of the Arya. Now, he greatly and with a real will recast this first chapter. A lot of it is still present in his revision. This never saw publication, of course, in book form during his life. It only came out in later years. But I thought I would read to you the first paragraph of this chapter as it appeared in the Arya. Chapter 16, The Object of Knowledge. By our analysis of the path of Karma Yoga, we have been able to map out in its broad lines and essential stages the movement by which the soul, liberated from desire and egoism, can become free in the divine. The realization of the divine, the Lord, the Supreme Self, through works, the union with the divine, by works and in works, the power to live in the presence of that and in its being and no longer in the ego, is the goal to which, by this path, we ascend. And it is evident that by this path we can arrive also at the supreme knowledge, which is the fruit of the yoga of knowledge, and the supreme love and ecstasy, which is the fruit of the yoga of devotion. Nevertheless, the particular form of the knowledge at which we shall first arrive by the path of works is that of the self as the supreme, transcendent, and universal Purusha, holding and conditioning the works of nature in the individual life and soul. And the particular form of devotion proper to this path is that offered to the Lord as the master of the world and its works, the devotion of self-surrender, self-dedication, sacrifice of all our being and activities to the divine. The whole knowledge and the whole ecstasy, not limited by any form, can be added and must come to us if we seek them. Once we stand in the presence and live in the being of the Lord and Supreme Soul. But they come more directly with a more spontaneous and integral fullness by the special self-discipline and the peculiar methods which belong to the other two branches of the triune path. To these paths, successively, we must now direct our attention. So worth reading, because that is the transition. We can get the full knowledge through the path of works, but there is something special that comes in the peculiar advantages offered to us by Jnana Yoga, the yoga of knowledge, and Bhakti Yoga, the yoga of devotion. Now, as he wrote this, of course, he didn't set out a table of contents, a prospectus of what he would be covering month by month as he went. So, we look at the contents, and we can see clearly there's a direction. He begins with the object of knowledge, the status of knowledge, the purified understanding. So, discussing what is the state of realization. Then comes back to look at what's going to take you there, concentration, renunciation, the synthesis of the disciplines of knowledge. And then all the conditions that go into that, the release from subjection to the body, the release from the heart and the mind, the release from the ego. So you can see us untying ourselves to bondage, starting with the body and then moving up. Finally, the release from the ego leads to the realization of the cosmic self. When you're no longer this little bitty thing, you can become one with that which is immense. And then the modes of the self, because why should there only be one mode of the self? The realization of Satchidananda follows that. The difficulties of the mental being, so we come back to look at what is perplexing to the mind in its experience of this supreme nature of existence, consciousness, and delight. Then the passive and the active Brahman, coming back then to the cosmic consciousness, to the experience of oneness, to the apparent division of soul and nature and how they really are one reality. So, the soul and its liberation, the planes of our existence, an echo back to the modes of the self, the lower triple Purusha, the ladder of self-transcendence, so our way up, vijnana or gnosis, the conditions that lead to the attainment of the gnosis. Gnosis fused into ananda, untold, untellable delight. The higher and the lower knowledge, because though we've climbed high, we must come back and reclaim all that is here in the material, vital, and mental world and make sure that it resonates with what we have discovered from above. What is samadhi? Why is it important to us? What is this rapt concentration in the One? Must it lead to a blankness of being? And then he closes with chapters on Hatha Yoga, the yoga of force. We come to that towards the end of this section, and then finally Raja Yoga, which people will interpret as being Patanjali's yoga. Patanjala. And The Yoga Sutras. Well, that will itself be a lengthy discussion. So now we can come to the beginning of chapter one, the object of knowledge. Must be an object. What are we aiming at? All spiritual seeking moves towards an object of knowledge to which men ordinarily do not turn the eye of the mind, to someone or something eternal, infinite, absolute, that is not the temporal things or forces of which we are sensible, although he or it may be in them or behind them or their source or creator. An object of knowledge. Knowledge in Sanskrit is jnana. It's that J with an N with the funny squiggle over it and a long A and then an N and another A. It means knowledge, direct and true. An essential, unshakable knowledge. A knowledge, as he will say in a moment, by identity, by identity. And it's a phrase that we've become familiar with in our reading of the Life Divine. So the essential knowledge is knowledge by identity. It aims at a state of knowledge by which we can touch, enter, or know by identity, this eternal, infinite, and absolute, a consciousness other than our ordinary consciousness of ideas and forms and things, a knowledge that is not what we call knowledge, but something self-existent, everlasting, infinite. So he is driving us towards an essence of being, a seeking for knowledge. This is the it. It aims at a state. It is the seeking that aims at the state. The soul seeks. And it seeks the secret of what is behind the transience of life, behind these millions of forces and beings that we can barely regard, let alone understand. Something self-existent, everlasting, infinite. This is not something which is a part of our mundane experience. And although it may or even necessarily must, since man is a mental creature, start from our ordinary instruments of knowledge, yet it must as necessarily go beyond them and use suprasensuous and supramental means and faculties. For it is in search of something that is itself suprasensuous and supramental, and beyond the grasp of the mind and senses, even if through mind and sense there can come a first glimpse of it or a reflected image. So we begin with the tools of the lower knowledge, the ordinary knowledge, including how we measure things, how we define, how we use our skills at language and mathematics to devise a simulacrum of the world that's before us and guess at what is behind the moving world. But those instruments, even the best knowledge that we can get, the queen of sciences, physics, all of it is apara vidya, the lower knowledge. If we aim at something which is beyond, then we seek para vidya, the science of the supreme. And that demands from us that we learn to know not through cogitation, not through thought, not through logical process, not by compiling data and analyzing them, once compiled, but with a direct sight that fuses the subject, the seer, with the object, the seen. And that which is produced in that productive union is knowledge. Suprasensuous, beyond the senses, supramental, beyond the mind. Sri Aurobindo will not at this stage describe to us what he means by supramental, except to connote, to suggest that there are ranges of conscious being which transcend the divisions and the limited view of the mind. We can get through the mind, through the compilations of our sense data, a glimpse of it. And it stuns us when we see it. We can receive a reflected image, but that simulacrum is not the thing in itself. You remember the Upanishads, even referring back to the Veda, describes that there is a world of truth, but it's separated from us by this golden lid. So what seems to be true, what seems to be golden, separates us from what is really golden. And we're satisfied with it. We've climbed so high, we've worked so hard and gone so far to reach even that pinnacle of mentality that we're ready to declare victory and go home. But Sri Aurobindo will not declare victory and go home early. So now he begins an analysis of what he calls the traditional systems. So, the traditional systems, whatever their other differences, all proceed on the belief or the perception that the eternal and absolute can only be, or at least can only inhabit, a pure transcendent state of non-cosmic existence, or else a non-existence. All cosmic existence, or all that we call existence, is a state of ignorance. Even the highest individual perfection, even the most blissful cosmic condition, is no better than a supreme ignorance. All that is individual, all that is cosmic, has to be austerely renounced by the seeker of the absolute truth. So he's saying this is the perspective of the knowledge systems, jnana yoga, and by imputation, Buddhism. I don't think that's quite a fair characterization, but he's on a roll. But here again, we have him discussing in one go the transcendent, the universal, and the individual, which you know has been a perpetual theme of his in the Life Divine and in the synthesis of yoga to this point. He will not give up any of these three poises of being, transcendent, universal, or individual. He continues in his argument. The supreme quiescent self, or else the absolute nihil, is the sole truth, the only object of spiritual knowledge. Well, the supreme quiescent self, we can presume to be the Atman. So, nihil would be shunya. So he's speaking fairly transparently about Advaita Vedanta and Buddhism. The state of knowledge, the consciousness other than this temporal that we must attain, is nirvana, an extinction of ego, a cessation of all mental, vital, and physical activities, of all activities whatsoever, a supreme illumined quiescence, the pure bliss of an impersonal tranquility, self-absorbed and ineffable. Nirvana is a word in Sanskrit that means blown out or blowing out. It's a statement about the nature of the consciousness. It's not an existential state. You can't say that this is a field of being. You can say that this is a condition in which ego is absent. Now, nirvana can mean a lot of things. We know that for Sri Aurobindo, his experience of Brahman nirvana, of his absorption into Brahman in 1908, his first great spiritual realization, erased from him all figuring of ego. It was simply gone. That only existed. But there was a that. There was no question that was real. The connotation that Buddhism brings to nirvana is that once that ego is gone, there is no French referential self to ask questions which don't edify. Where is God? What is the absolute? What's the nature of the cosmos, etc.? That was not Buddha's business. His business was to abstract the consciousness from identification with the elements of nature. And when you realize that there is no entity there, that led to the death of ego, the extinction of ego. It's annihilation, it's blowing out, left nothing there. That doesn't mean that there's no consciousness. Buddha, after attaining nirvana, continued to work because he knew that he could sit in that state or he could come back and try to talk to people in a way that made sense to them and lead them away from a state of convicted suffering. So, until he was 80 years old, he did that. That's not a life of absolute quietude. There is an idea in some schools of jnana yoga that the purest state of knowledge means everything falls away. We're coming to that. Sri Aurobindo is describing it like that, but some of the imputation here about what Buddhism teaches, what some schools of Vedanta teach, is it could be phrased differently. So to get to this supreme illumined quiescence, the pure bliss that he describes, he says, the means are meditation, a concentration excluding all things else, a total loss of the mind in its object. See, this is a clear reference to the Yoga Sutras. Meditation, dhyana. Concentration, dharana. Excluding all things else. And a total loss of the mind in its object, samadhi. Action is permissible only in the first stages of the search in order to purify the seeker and make him morally and temperamentally a fit vessel for the knowledge. But action is not enjoined upon the seeker, according to the Yoga Sutras. Again, we're reading into this what Sri Aurobindo is likely referring to. So, a total loss of the mind and its object means that subject and object have become one. There is no division any longer. There's a merger. Hence the oneness, hence the yoking of the consciousness to that thing which is seen and the state of yoga. So he says action is permissible only to prepare. You're getting ready for it. And so as long as you're somewhat still addicted to the life of the world, so long as you feel it incumbent upon you to act in virtuous ways, etc., you can follow the ways of Dharma, of Shastra, etc. But they'll eventually fall off, because only you should sit in the purity of this knowledge. Even this action must either be confined to the performance of the rites of worship and the prescribed duties of life rigorously ordained by the Hindu Shastra, or, as in the Buddhistic discipline, must be guided along the Eightfold Path to the supreme practice of the works of compassion, which lead towards the practical annihilation of self in the good of others. In the end, in any severe and pure jnana yoga, all works must be abandoned for an entire quiescence. Action may prepare salvation, it cannot give it. Any continued adherence to action is incompatible with the highest progress and may be an insuperable obstacle to the attainment of the spiritual goal. The supreme state of quiescence is the very opposite of action and cannot be attained by those who persist in works. And even devotion, love, worship are disciplines for the unripe soul, or at best, the best methods of the ignorance. For they are offered to something other, higher and greater than ourselves. But in the supreme knowledge, there can be no such thing, since there is either only one self or no self at all, and therefore either no one to do the worship and offer the love and devotion, or no one to receive it. Even thought activity must disappear in the sole consciousness of identity and or of nothingness, and by its own quiescence bring about the quiescence of the whole nature. The absolute identical alone must remain, or else the eternal nihil. So the identical means identity. And who has an identity? The self, the Atman. So it's either the self or the not self, yes? Atman or Anatman. So this is not Sri Aurobindo's position, but he's saying this is the extreme to which jnana yoga would take you. This pure jnana yoga comes by the intellect, although it ends in the transcendence of the intellect and its workings. The thinker in us separates himself from all the rest of what we phenomenally are, rejects the heart, draws back from the life and the senses, separates from the body, that he may arrive at his own exclusive fulfillment and that which is beyond even himself and his function. There is a truth that underlies, is there is an experience that seems to justify this attitude. There is an essence that is in its nature a quiescence, a supreme of silence in the being that is beyond its own developments and mutations, immutable and therefore superior to all activities of which it is at most a witness. And in the hierarchy of our psychological functions, the thought is in a way nearest to this self, nearest at least to its aspect of the all-conscious knower who regards all activities but can stand back from them all. So again, this is Purusha separating itself from Prakriti, and the mind has best the capacity of these evolved agencies to attain that. And so most often when one gets free from the nature, it is through manomaya purusha, through the mind, the purusha at the level of this mind action, looking at nature and saying, I am not that. That's the level of divorce. The heart, will, and other powers in us are fundamentally active, turn naturally towards action, find through it their fulfillment, although they also may automatically arrive at a certain quiescence by fullness of satisfaction in their activities, or else by a reverse process of exhaustion through perpetual disappointment and dissatisfaction. So he's not saying it here, but these are the two elements in Indian philosophy of pravritti and nivritti. Pravritti is the outward going movement of consciousness and force of nature that propels, that moves into the evolution of things. Nivritti means it's the inward going. You're bringing it back away from it. You haven't enjoyed that experience out there, and now you're coming back. So the one is embracing the world, going into it with reckless abandon. The other is saying, this sickens me. I'm leaving and coming back. The thought, too, is an active power, but is more capable of arriving at quiescence by its own conscious choice and will. The thought is more easily content with the illumined intellectual perception of this silent witness self that is higher than all our activities. And that immobile spirit, once seen, is ready, deeming its mission of truth-finding accomplished, to fall at rest and become itself immobile. So again, a restatement that the witness self, the sakshi, poise of the purusha, regarding all of this, says, no, thank you, I've had enough. I withdraw into my own luminous being. But this is, again, the mind as purusha undertaking this. For in its most characteristic movement, it is itself apt to be a disinterested witness, judge, observer of things, more than an eager participant and passionate laborer in the work, and can arrive very readily at a spiritual or philosophic calm and detached aloofness. So this is the philosopher who's sitting at one remove, surveying and judging things from something of a distance, not so eager to get involved in it himself. And since men are mental beings, thought, if not truly their best and highest, is at least their most constant, normal, and effective means for enlightening their ignorance. Armed with its functions of gathering and reflection, meditation, fixed contemplation, the absorbed dwelling of the mind on its object, shravana, manana, nididhyasana, it stands at our tops as an indispensable aid to our realization of that which we pursue. And it is not surprising that it should claim to be the leader of the journey and the only available guide, or at least the direct and innermost door of the temple. So this is a direct drawing from Advaita Vedanta. Sravana means hearing, therefore study. You study and analyze the nature of things. Manana is thinking, means reflecting. You've got this body of knowledge that you're looking at. You're looking at the way the world is assembled, what composes it. And then nididhyasana, that's this fixed and unbroken meditation, which doesn't move. It's an asana. You're seated in this, yeah? Which helps you to remove contrary mental tendencies that want to draw you out. So, hearing, thinking, sitting, and concentrating upon is what leads you eventually to a great knowledge, which is anupalabdhi, which means non-cognition. There is no more a self which sees. There is no more an object to be seen. There is simply the experience of that. So this is interesting, this idea. By the way, let's note something here about Sri Aurobindo. This is wonderful the way he writes. So he begins by describing gathering, reflection, meditation, fixed contemplation, the absorbed dwelling of the mind on its object, and then he gives us the Sanskrit. So he leads us from the near to the far. You don't know Sanskrit, but he teaches it to you. First he teaches you the English, and then he tells you what is the Sanskrit. It's wonderful. Because he could stupefy us if he wished to. But he doesn't do that. So, by the way, this idea of a mental being, let's translate it. Let's use Sri Aurobindo's translation from the Mundaka Upanishad, the second chapter, the second section, and the eighth verse says, a mental being, leader, neta, of the life and the body, prana sharira, has set a heart in matter. In matter, he has taken his firm foundation. So Sri Aurobindo may be quoting this and saying that, yes, the mind is the evolved leader of the life and the body. And it should, if there are only these three elements. Then the mind is your better guide here, not the vital passion, not the lazy body that wants to lie in the sun. It also says, this verse, that it leads to a discovery of the ananda rupam, of the form of delight, which is that of the eternal. So it's a very pregnant section in the Mundaka. But let's go forward. In reality, thought is only a scout and pioneer. It can guide, but not command or effectuate. So remember, we were talking about Sankhya, the description that Purusha watches Prakriti. Purusha is separate as the witness from Prakriti, which is the engaged machinery of nature, which dances because Purusha watches, granted. But the mind offers thought as only a scout and pioneer. Manas goes out and collects all the data from the world. It comes back and assembles what the senses have driven to it into a kind of composite whole. But it is not capable of really judging that. It has to offer it to a higher, illumined intelligence, which is the buddhi, the highest peak of what nature can attain, before one is illumined, truly illumined. So let's read that again. In reality, thought is only a scout and pioneer. It can guide, but not command or effectuate. The leader of the journey, the captain of the march, the first and most ancient priest of our sacrifice is the will. Rig Veda, Mandala 1, first verse, first Rik. Agni, this will is not The wish of the heart, or the demand or preference of the mind, to which we often give the name, it is that inmost, dominant, and often veiled conscious force of our being and of all being, tapas, shakti, shraddha, that sovereignly determines our orientation, and of which the intellect and the heart are more or less blind and automatic servants and instruments. So, when we are led properly, it's because the spirit, the force of the spirit within us, Agni as a power, representing tapas, Agni is fire. This is the mystic fire. What is the nature of tapas? But compressed fire, heat, which burns and glows and becomes concentrated into a shining mass. Shakti, which is the expression of that heat, released into action. Shraddha, which is the faith's forceful determination, the faith that rises from the soul. And if Agni is not the soul, there is no soul. That sovereignly determines our orientation, and of which the intellect and the heart are more or less blind and automatic servants and instruments. He writes that this will, articulate as the soul power in our being, raised back into oneness with knowledge, that will reunited with knowledge is the effective power in life of the truth consciousness. So if you want to bring the supramental here to earth, find this soul within, find the source of all power and illumination within your own being, and draw down the higher knowledge from above, and then in that suffused oneness, that with this, you can move towards the farther goal of the integral yoga. The self that is quiescent, at rest, vacant of things and happenings, is a support and background to existence, a silent channel, or a hypostasis of something supreme. It is not itself the one entirely real existence, not itself the supreme. The eternal, the supreme, is the Lord and the all-originating spirit. This is all the way back to the Bhagavad Gita, where there's a supreme person, Purushottama, who has a supreme nature, para-prakriti, who throws uncountable forms of itself into being to ensoul and populate the universe that it itself creates, and it establishes as a ground of its own being the matrix, the industrial necessary stuff of the world, this silent akshara Brahman, from which all is drawn, for the below, and which draws its own truth from above, from Purushottama. So hypostasis, by the way, it means literally like understanding. Hypo means under. Stasis means setting or standing. So it means standing under. So if you want to understand something, you have to get back to this root. So this is the basis. A hypostasis is a basis, a foundation. It is substance or essence, a silent channel or hypostasis of something supreme, Purushottama, that is the Lord. Ishvara, superior to all activities and not bound by any of them, it is the source, sanction, material, efficient power, master of all activities. All activities proceed from this supreme self and are determined by it. All are its operations, processes of its own conscious force, chit-shakti, and not of something alien to self. some power other than the Spirit. So this world is not divorced from that silent self that Advaita seeks. It is that silent self in a vibrant dance. In these activities is expressed the conscious will or shakti of the Spirit moved to manifest its being in infinite ways, a will or power not ignorant, but at one with its own self-knowledge and its knowledge of all that it is put out to express. And of this power, a secret spiritual will and soul faith in us, Shraddha and Agni together again, the dominant hidden force of our nature, is the individual instrument more nearly in communication with the Supreme, a surer guide and enlightener, could we once get at it and hold it, because profounder and more intimately near to the identical and absolute than the surface activities of our thought powers. So hidden from us, our soul waits to be discovered. And it will lead us surely into a deep and profound communion with the Supreme, and its executive force will flow through that illumined soul as it lives and moves on earth in a body. To know that will in ourselves and in the universe and follow it to its divine finalities, whatever these may be, must surely be the highest way and truest culmination for knowledge as for works, for the seeker in life and for the seeker in yoga. So he integrates and makes congruent world and self and God. And this takes us back to the first page of the Life Divine, the earliest formula of wisdom, promises to be its last. God, light, freedom, immortality. So we pause there. We don't rest there. So, you'll indulge me, I hope, as we read from Savitri. Book 1, Canto 5, The Yoga of the King. The Yoga of the Spirit's Freedom and Greatness. We begin on page 74. This knowledge first he had of time-born men, admitted through a curtain of bright mind that hangs between our thoughts and absolute sight. He found the occult cave, the mystic door, near to the well of vision in the soul, and entered where the wings of glory brood, in the silent space where all is forever known. Indifferent to doubt and to belief, avid of the naked real's single shock, he shore the cord of mind that ties the earth heart and cast away the yoke of matter's law. The body's rules bound not the spirit's powers. When life had stopped its beats, death broke not in. He dared to live when breath and thought were still. Thus could he step into that magic place, which few can even glimpse with hurried glance, lifted for a moment from mind's labored works and the poverty of nature's earthly sight. All that the gods have learned is there self-known. There, in a hidden chamber, closed and mute, are kept the record graphs of the cosmic scribe. And there the tables of the sacred law. There is the Book of Being's index page. The text and glossary of the Vedic truth are there, the rhythms and meters of the stars, significant of the movements of our fate, the symbol powers of number and of form, and the secret code of the history of the world, and nature's correspondence with the soul, are written in the mystic heart of life. In the glow of the spirit's room of memories, he could recover the luminous marginal notes, dotting with light the crabbed, ambiguous scroll, rescue the preamble and the saving clause of the dark agreement by which all is ruled that rises from material nature's sleep, to clothe the everlasting in new shapes. He could reread now and interpret new its strange symbol letters, scattered abstruse signs, resolve its oracle and its paradox, its riddling phrases and its blindfold terms, the deep oxymoron of its truth's repliques, and recognize as a just necessity its hard conditions for the mighty work, nature's impossible Herculean toil, only her warlock wisecraft could enforce, its law of the opposition of the gods, its list of inseparable contraries. The dumb great mother, in her cosmic trance, exploiting for creation's joy and pain, infinity's sanction to the birth of form, accepts indomitably to execute the will to know in an inconscient world, the will to live under a reign of death, the thirst for rapture in a heart of flesh, and works out through the appearance of a soul, by a miraculous birth in plasm and gas, the mystery of God's covenant with the night. Once more was heard in the still cosmic mind the Eternal's promise to his laboring force, inducing the world passion to begin, the cry of birth into mortality, and the opening verse of the tragedy of time. Out of the depths, the world's buried secret rose. He read the original UKs kept back in the locked archives of the spirit's crypt, and saw the signature and fiery seal of wisdom on the dim power's hooded work, who builds in ignorance the steps of light. A sleeping deity opened deathless eyes. He saw the unshaped thought in soulless forms, new matter pregnant with spiritual sense, mind, dare the study of the unknowable, life, its gestation of the golden child. In the light flooding thought's blank vacancy, interpreting the universe by soul signs, he read from within the text of the without. The riddle grew plain and lost its catch obscure. A larger luster lit the mighty page. A purpose mingled with the whims of time, a meaning met the stumbling pace of chance, and fate revealed a chain of seeing will. A conscious wideness filled the old dumb space. In the void, he saw throned the omniscience supreme. Hmm. Namaste. Jai Ma.